Welcome to The Politics Guys. I'm Michael Baranowski, a political scientist at Northern Kentucky University. My guest today is historian Ray Raphael, author of, if my count is right, 21 books now, including Founding Myths, Constitutional Myths, and the recently released Annotated Guide to the U.S. Constitution, which I have a copy of right here in front of me, in fact, today. And it's a really nice volume, this great format. You can really just about slip it into your pocket if you want. I've really enjoyed reading through it, and so I'm really pleased to be able to talk with Ray about it today. So, Ray, welcome to the show.
Well, pleased to be talking with you, Mike.
So I thought I'd start just with a pretty straightforward question. Why an annotated guide to the Constitution? You know, what prompted you to write this book?
Well, it was a very definite event, and it's an event that a lot of people will be able to recall. At the Democratic National Convention, Khazir Khan, the Gold Star father, took out his pocket edition of the Constitution, waved it in the air, and said, "Mr. Trump, I think you should read this. You can borrow my copy," or some such. Instantly, the Constitution became a bestseller. So people thought, hey, we should read this thing just like everybody should, because people were sensing that we were going beyond the Constitution. And so Vintage, which is one of my publishers, they're part of Knopf and Random House and so on, Penguin, that group, they contacted me and said, "We want to put out an annotated version of the Constitution, and we want to do it quickly before the election in an ebook." So I said, "Hey, that sounds like a great idea, because we sure need a Constitution now as much as ever." And so I did it. I worked night and day for a while and got it out. Then, lo and behold, Trump got elected. And that raised a whole new set of issues, such as nobody really cared about the Emoluments Clause before, you know, basically a clause that says you can't get rich from your office. And suddenly everybody did care about that. And then all sorts of things cropped up about executive power and abuse of executive power. So then we decided, okay, let's really do this thing. I went over it and did it more thoroughly. And so that's what we have now. It's the Constitution. Let's see, the formal title is U.S. Constitution Explains Clause by Clause for Every American Today. And that's exactly what I tried to do. I tried to translate Constitution ease into the modern language, the modern idiom, because they spoke a different language then. For instance, in the Constitution, it refers to domestic violence. Well, when we hear domestic violence, we think spousal abuse. They were talking about civil insurrections. So that just is indicative of the disjoint between then and now. And I was trying in this annotation to bridge that disjoint, to explain what the Constitution meant then and how it can be applied now.
So how do you go about doing something like that? I mean, obviously you start with the words of the document, but what's the process, I guess, that you went through to try to make that translation?
Well, the process is basically 20 years of research.
Okay. You know,
I've been in this field for a while.
Uh-huh.
And what it is the Constitution appears. For every article and section of the Constitution, it appears right there. And then I select out the choice phrases that really are the key phrases of that and the ones that we need to understand what they meant and how what that might mean now. So it's just a clause, as it says, it's clause by clause. You just go through the whole thing, and all sorts of things emerge about that really shed great light on what's happening today and basically the potential and real abuses of the Constitution today.
Now, were there any parts of doing this that you really struggled with, you know, phrases or amendments or things that just were a little more resistant to a plain 21st century English translation?
Well, I'll tell you, the hardest thing to explain is this bizarre electoral college that we got stuck with. And as a matter of fact, I actually wrote a whole book about it on the creation of the presidency called Mr. President, How and Why Founders Created Chief Executive. And it's hard to explain because it's just absolutely bizarre. It was kind of a last-minute addition to the Constitution, literally. What happened is at the convention, Congress was the originally the Articles of Confederation was only one body. It was just that was the original Constitution that our Constitution supplanted. It was just Congress. That's what all there is. They wanted to create a stronger and more elaborate government that included an executive and a judiciary branch. But what would that mean? They didn't want the executive to be like a king. So what did they want? They really struggled with that. And in particular, how would the president, they wound up calling the office the president, how would he or she be elected or she elected? And they just assumed that Congress would do that because that's Congress did everything under the Articles of Confederation. But some people wanted popular election to be presidency. That was resoundingly rejected. As George Mason said, the people electing the president would be like trusting a trial of colors to a blind man. That didn't trust the people. So they went back and forth. With 2 weeks, less than 2 weeks to go, Congress selected the president. That's the way it was. Some people said, no, that doesn't create an independent branch. So it's kind of like elaborate committee jockeying through this committee James Wilson and Gouverneur Morris were kind of spearheading this thing. And they came up with this strange scheme called the Electoral College, which was supposed to bypass all politics. People would choose their electors, and these could not be elected officials. They could not be political figures. They were just supposed to choose the wisest people, the sages, the local sages. And those local sages would gather in their local state houses and cast their votes for the wisest president. And so presumably we were supposed to have a totally apolitical selection of the presidency. That's what they came up with, this very elaborate scheme. And you had to vote for two people because otherwise everybody might just vote for the people in their state and the big states would have an advantage. So you vote for two, and the one was had the top vote getting the president and the other the vice president. Well, this strange scheme, there wasn't a vice president before this concept. And this strange scheme was introduced with less than 2 weeks to go before the convention ended. They had been struggling for over 3 months, and they were so tired to get home, they just kind of threw up their hands and said, okay, whatever, and that's how we have the Electoral College. Now, what happened is in the first contested presidential election in 1796, Washington was uncontested. And by that time, two parties had formed, the Federalists behind John Adams and what they called at that point the Republicans behind Thomas Jefferson. And the political operatives of each of these parties kind of went to the state level, and they put up slates of electors pledged to their specific delegates, their specific candidates, and then all those pledged electors voted like they were pledged. So the plan originally was to have these people be totally apolitical and just vote just for the people. That the electors were to have absolute discretion and just vote for the wisest person, the best leader. And quickly, in the first test, it failed miserably. And ever since, it's been pledged electors, and we're stuck with this whole strange scheme and the bizarre counting of it and how you count it. Kind of, was a whole compromise between the small states and the big states and blah blah blah. And so this scheme has resulted now in five people who received the majority votes not being granted the presidency, including two of the last three. So that's kind of hard to explain. And I mean, I gave you the 5-minute version of an entire book, but it shows that what their concerns. It, interestingly enough, their concerns were that things would become overly politicized. They were very worried about creating a partisan environment. And the point of creating the president was to create a figure who was above partisanship and was supposed to kind of mediate between what they considered would be the more aristocratic Senate and the Democratic House. And the president was supposed to, be the mediator between them. What happened is they just, instead of, it's kind of like Oedipus fearing his fate creates his fate. And that's exactly what happened, that in trying to create this apolitical office, they created a hyper-political office, because now every party, it would guarantee a two-party system, because now, you know, whoever controlled the presidency just had so much power. And so that became a zero-sum game. One party is going to control it. And so basically two parties are going to merge, the top two parties, and those are going to be the only viable contenders. And they're going to fight tooth and nail for the presidency. And that has now exaggerated to the point where that basically people within at least one of those parties are just blatantly violating the Constitution in order to preserve their power.
One thing I did, the first thing when I got my copy of the book, I turned right to the page where you get into the Second Amendment, which I imagine a lot of people will be doing who buy the book. And so I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how you went about explicating that so very controversial amendment.
Well, first of all, my method as a historian is I pretty much ignore all later accounts and I go right to primary sources, what we call contemporaneous sources, the documents of the time. So when I'm looking at what the 10th Amendment means, I go back to those, the Second Amendment, what was behind it. I go back to, okay, what were they debating then? What was at issue and what was the problem they were trying to solve? And when I find that, it's very clear in the debates that they're talking about militias. And the reason they're talking about militias is because under the article, before the Constitution, all the militias were basically controlled by the states and local authorities. You know, the militias were basically the military embodiment of the people. And so, they had town meetings, which is the political embodiment, and then they had militias, the military embodiment of the people. The Constitution actually authorized the federal government to have eventual control, ultimate control over the militias. They could call the militias out, and they would be ultimately, Congress actually, in its 18 powers, two of them relate to, organizing and controlling militias. And people at the time were very worried that now that there could be a standing army, which the Constitution authorized and people had been scared of, that the standing armies would become strong and the military embodiment of the people, the militias, would wither, the federal government would allow them to wither. So they said that the militias had to be basically well-regulated, disciplined militias, had to be maintained. That was a right of the states and the people to have them. So that's what it's all about. It says it guarantees the right of the people to embody as a body. The militias, by the way, this idea that there's now these private militias, and that's an oxymoron. There's no such thing as a private militia. The militia is a public body. The militia is part of the government. It's the military involvement, military embodiment of the people as a whole. That's what it means. So, I mean, that's kind of simple. Now, so basically today the debate is all about, is it about militias or is it about private ownership? Well, historically it was about militias. Why was private ownership not addressed in the Second Amendment? Because nobody ever questioned it. I mean, of course people can have guns. I mean, you're gonna put in a constitutional amendment guaranteeing the right to own horses and tools. And, a gun was just on that caliber. I mean, of course you have the right to. So ironically, both sides of the debate in terms of how they debate are generally kind of just off the mark. The framers assumed the right to own personal arms. They did, but that's not part of the Constitution because it didn't have to be. They were concerned about the militias. Now, one other thing I want to say about that, though, is that the framers of the Constitution also would have had absolutely no problem with regulating firearms for safety purposes. And as a matter of fact, they did that extensively. At issue was not the muskets themselves. That wasn't the issue at that time. It was the gunpowder and the storage of the gunpowder. So in all these highly dense residential settlements, there were strict laws about how you store your gunpowder, because that's a safety concern. So the idea that there's some kind of inherent conflict between the right of gun ownership and public safety is ridiculous. Of course there's not. Both, you know, the right, there's a right of ownership, but it's got to be, but it's certainly, government is within its right, with, you know, it certainly has the authority to limit that to the point that it becomes a threat to public safety. So the whole debate, I find, you know, it's relatively recent, actually, just in the last few decades, and basically just historically off the mark. It's our debate, and people, it's disguised as a constitutional debate.
Interesting. There's another part of the Constitution that doesn't get nearly as much attention, but I'll kind of be a little wonkier and say I think it, in some ways, it's considerably more important. And I'm thinking about the Commerce Clause. And it seems to me that starting in the early 20th century, Congress used the Commerce Clause to really vastly increase federal power. And I'm wondering if you think that this was something that the framers would have intended or approved of, or what?
The history of the Commerce, and the jurisprudence of the Commerce Clause is very cyclical. And if we want to look just at the framers, the Commerce Clause is basically the third power of authorized to Congress. There's 18 powers listed in Article 1, Section 8 to Congress. And by the way, the reason these powers are listed to Congress is because in the framers' mind, Congress is the primary governing body. It's not the president. I mean, there are three branches. Congress, the people's representative, makes the laws. Remember, by the way, that the president for them did not represent the people. He was very removed from the people. He was, you know, the people elected the electors, and then the electors elected the president. But the House of Representatives was the direct representatives of the people. They had the powers. They made the laws. The president's authority was to execute them. And as a matter of fact, it was not just an authority. It was an order. He was to faithfully execute the laws. That was the president's job. So the idea, this is tangential, but I'm commenting on it now. The idea, for instance, that you can take a law of Congress, such as the environmental protection laws, and that are placed under the jurisdiction of the Environmental Protection Agency, and have the president not execute, you know, state that this law shall not be executed, is just not right. I mean, it's the law of Congress. And if Congress said that this agency execute the laws, it's the president's duty and the executive's duty to faithfully execute the laws. Okay, so now back to these authorities of Congress, you know, the 18 powers they're granted. The very first one is taxation, because the whole problem with the lack of government at that time is the inability to raise money. Congress cannot authorize taxes, you know, levy taxes. And as a matter of fact, Congress only took in $663 to run the entire federal machinery in the 6 months before the Constitutional Convention. So they said, okay, the first power, we need to have taxes. The second power, we need to be able to borrow money. Obviously, you know, these are the things we have to do. The third power now, that is the Commerce Clause. And that, because that was kind of the essence of the Constitution. Like, what we're doing is we're establishing a body, and it can raise its own money that is fiscally viable, and they can actually serve as the kind of mediator across state lines for all sorts of commerce. That, you know, basically, what is our national economy? How can we work out the differences among the states? So it's a sweeping power, and how to interpret that power, you know, how sweeping, has just varied with the ages. And sometimes it's been used basically as a very pro-business clause, and sometimes it's been used to regulate business. So, you know, there's this kind of pendulum. But it basically, it is intended to be sweeping. The 18th clause, the necessary and proper clause in the powers of Congress, gives Congress the power, gives powers that are necessary and proper to implement any of those, the first 17 clauses. So what clauses are we, you know, how that's interpreted, that's up to the basically bodies of government and ultimately the Supreme Court. And as I say, it wavers. And most people thought, I think, that because the the healthcare in our country accounts for some 18% of the national economy. That should certainly be considered as a legitimate field for the Congress to address under the Commerce Clause. And so that seems like a plausible argument. Strangely enough, the Supreme Court held 5-4 that was not a sufficient argument. And the only reason Obamacare was sustained was because Chief Justice Roberts had a different argument, saying that it was actually a taxation.
Yep. Some people would say, well, it's true that the Commerce Clause and Necessary and Proper Clause give Congress sweeping powers, but something that maybe starting in the early 20th century has kind of fallen by the wayside is the 10th Amendment, which seems to suggest that actually the states have quite a bit of authority there, and that's been too much ignored by courts and by the federal government in, I would say, recent years and over a century, actually. Well, what do you think about that?
Well, let's look at the 10th Amendment. Okay, hang on one second as I just flip open my little handy guide to actually get the exact wording of the 10th Amendment.
I'll do the same.
Okay. So let's see. Here's my explanation of it. Okay. Here is the reading of the 10th Amendment. The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. And this was a sweeping amendment. Now, it has to be read in conjunction with that 18th power of Congress. The 18th power of Congress gives Congress the power to over any item that is necessary and sufficient. Necessary to administer the first 17 items. Okay, so that gives kind of necessary and proper, and so that gives a very broad thing. Well, people are worried that wait a second, that what we call the elastic clause could be too broad. So they said the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, which are basically those 18 powers, are reserved to the states. Okay, so that's much more restrictive, but it wasn't restrictive enough for some delegates, and they wanted to insert the word expressly before delegated. So it would say the powers not expressly delegated to the United States are reserved to the states or the people, and that would be very restrictive. So Congress, the first federal Congress who drafted these amendments, they debated that clause, that amendment, and they decided explicitly not to put in the word explicitly. They said, no, we're not talking about explicitly delegated, because explicitly delegated would negate implied powers. And some powers, if you explicitly delegate, what's explicitly delegated? Well, one of the powers is that they're delegated the power to raise an army and a navy. Okay, now do they have the power to raise an air? Does Congress have the power to raise an air force? And if the word explicitly is in there, it would be no. They don't. They can only raise an army and navy. So they not putting the word explicitly was their way of saying, hey, listen, we need to rein in. We don't want that 18th power of Congress in the authority of Congress in the body of the Constitution to be so expensive that it includes everything, but we can't limit it that tightly either. So all of the jurisprudence and all of the politics since that time have been kind of weighing those two variables. You need some, obviously, you want an Air Force, you want some implied power, but they can't be too, they can't be too expansive. And that's the general guidelines that the framers and the first federal Congress in the Bill of Rights have given us. And within that is the groundwork, that's the framework, the playing field under which we now operate. And then how we operate under that playing field, sometimes it's really very political. If you don't want something to happen, you'll say, well, it's violated under the Tenth Amendment, and then suddenly you just reverse the other way. For instance, just like the relative state powers, it used to be 2 years ago, Texas was giving all sorts of challenges to federal authority because they didn't really agree with a lot of Obama policies. And now suddenly, it's kind of the state's rights were from Texas. Now suddenly with Trump, it's California. And California is challenging a lot of Trump's policies and saying, no, we got, now California is, pointing to the 10th Amendment. And 2 years ago, Texas was reported. But the beauty of the Constitution is that it actually does give a, just because we all live under it and believe we live under it and claim we live under it and accept it, it gives us a kind of a language. But that language is quite, there's a lot of room within that language to do what we want to do. And we use that language of the Constitution to carry on our own current debates.
Right. Yeah, I wanted to ask you more specifically about that, because, of course, there are some people who say that the Constitution is a living document designed to adapt to the times, and that when we interpret it, we should be guided not throw away the words, but be guided by the spirit of the document. And then there are people on the other side who say, they don't say it's a dead document, but they refer to an originalist understanding, and that the words mean what they mean. And if you want to change it, you need to formally amend it. That's why there's an amendment process. Where do you stand on this debate?
Okay, I'm going to start with the originalist idea, because there is no such thing as a true originalist, and I'm going to prove that to you. It's actually something that Scalia himself pointed out. This is his example, which is ironic because he kind of claims to be an originalist, but he recognizes that this is a real problem. Let's look at the Eighth Amendment, cruel and unusual punishment, right? Okay. Now, if you take that, what the framers meant by that, okay, what did they mean by cruel and unusual at the time? Well, here's some things that were very usual. Hanging was very usual, right? So that's, and often they say that shows that, death penalty is perfectly fine. Also usual at the time is you could be lashed and branded in the hand for very minor offenses. So if you are a judge today and somebody's called into your court for shoplifting, and that defendant says, the sheriff lashed me and, gave me 50 lashes and branded my hand, and shows his branded hand to the judge and says, I think this is cruel and unusual. This is cruel and unusual punishment, right? Okay. What judge is going to say, no, that was okay in the Constitution, so that's okay now? Can you imagine the current judge saying, hey, no problem with that, Of course, because the times have changed. And so why did they say cruel and unusual and not specify anything? Clearly, they were not expecting society to remain absolutely static. Let's just take the issue of slavery. Nobody under the Constitution, maybe a few people in the Deep South, but certainly even the Virginia planters, nobody expected slavery to survive forever. They knew that eventually it was doomed. Most of them knew it was wrong. There were political reasons why they couldn't deal with that now, then having to do with it, that it would buttress the economy. And they knew there would be evolution. They allowed for amendments. They said, this is not perfect, but it's enough to start it. We can live with it. What their idea was not to solve all our political problems, because what the heck do they know about airport security and private rights, That wasn't their idea. Their idea was to create a framework by which people of the future, that would include us, have a framework by which to live by which they all claim to abide by these basic rules. And then as times change, they use those rules appropriately to the times that change. And so that once again, this living Constitution and originalism, it's something of a bogus debate. Of course, you can't take every word item for item. On the other hand, you can't just get too expansive, and just ignore such basic things as separation of powers. The separation of powers is real, and you do not want the executive running roughshod over Congress, for instance. And so, you know, there are broad parameters, but it's much like that issue with the 10th Amendment, which reserves rights to the people, and the Necessary and Proper Clause. It gives you these parameters, and within those parameters, you have your debates. And so long as everybody is basically goodwilled and says, you know, we want to come to a solution here, it will work out. Where it doesn't work out is where some people say, get so adamant and say, my way or the highway, and basically, you know, flout the Constitution blatantly. And there has been a recent example of that has been this, Supreme Court nominations. The Senate was given the nominations is with the advice and consent of the Senate. And certainly that means that the Senate should have its say. The notion that the Senate would not consider any candidate at all from a sitting president, that's flouting the Constitution. I'm going to give you another example of flouting the Constitution. Currently, there's the budget, the census director. There's a nominee. You know, somebody wants. Trump wants this guy to run the census. He's controversial, and he's controversial because his book is called Why Competitive Elections Are Bad for America. And so, you know, he's against competitive elections. That makes him controversial.
Okay? Yeah.
So here's the flouting of the Constitution. Okay. The Constitution requires the principal officers to receive the confirmation by the Senate. It doesn't say the cabinet. There was no such word. It just says ambassadors, principal officers, and so on. So generally, the director of the Census Bureau would receive confirmation. That office is now vacant. Okay, so this fellow, the idea is to not put him as director, but put him as assistant director and leave the office vacant. And so that he does not have to receive confirmation. That is a workaround in the Constitution. That is a flouting of the Constitution. See what I mean? It's not living within just the basic parameters of the obvious, such an obvious intent of the Constitution. So that, to me, that kind of thing is the most dangerous, when people are just willing to flout the whole thing. And that has been recent. Honestly, that has been recent. You know, there's been plenty of contentious times in recent past, but people have figured out a way to get along within Congress. The very idea of this, you know, Congress making these huge decisions without absolutely any input from 48% of the of its membership. No input whatsoever. I mean, that's what's sick. That's what's wrong. It's not wrong with the Constitution. It's wrong with people not willing to live within the basic, just obvious parameters of, you know, the point here is to make a functioning, workable government that allows us to have our political debates and allows us to work out compromises and move on. And that is what's broken today. And that is why I think we really need to look hard at that U.S. Constitution. And, so why I explained it clause by clause for every American today. That's my purpose in this.
Yeah, you mentioned the kind of whatever sort of approach that gave us the Electoral College. And, you know, it seems to me that what a lot of people may not realize is that the Constitution was, in many instances, the result of political compromises made by very smart but fallible human beings. And I'm wondering why you think that so much, there's such a reverence for the framers in the Constitution, almost to the point where if one dares to question something that's in the Constitution, you're just thought to be, that's thought to be out of bounds.
That's a very interesting question. And that's basically a cultural question. The idea of it's sort of like Chairman Mao or something, you know, I mean, we don't have Chairman Mao, you know, we have the Constitution, and the cultural reverence for it, is, and we are a culture that does that. Ironically, though, of course, we don't really live up to it because we basically then try to twist it all to our own ends. but it's you know, as in a lot of cultural phenomena, it serves a purpose. It has served a great purpose, which has been we have this long, we're the longest living national constitution, you know, and the reverence for the framers has been sort of that cultural, you know, treating them as these cultural icons has kind of like that's what it has given us. That's what it has given us. What it's kind of adverse side effect. It's kind of like a medicine that's basically good, you know? I mean, yeah, we should really, but then to say, you know, these things they can do no wrong. I mean, it's obvious. The whole slavery compromise thing, you know, and that's a whole other story. You know, where did they get up the idea of 3/5? Well, the South wanted to count them, the North didn't, okay? 4 years before that, they were trying to figure out whether how much money each state had to pay to the federal treasury, because that's how they got money, is from the states. And the South at that point said, don't count the slaves, you don't count horses. And the North said, count them, they work. And so it was the total reverse. You know, once the North wanted, in 1783, the North wanted to count them, the South didn't. 1787, for purposes of representation, they totally flip-flop, and they make the exact reverse argument. And so where did they come up with the 3/5 for the Constitution? They just look back 4 years and they say, well, we compromised on 3/5 then. Well, we'll just compromise on 3/5 now. I mean, that's how insane the politics was. So you can call that wise or anything. The truth is the framers lived in a political world. They were, people call them statesmen, not politicians. No, there's no ideal. There should be no differentiation between statesmen and politicians. People in public office have to be both. And the art of compromise is essential to moving on. And without that art of compromise, there would have been no nation. And who knows what would have happened. But anyway, and so, you know, you can't say the framers knew it all and they were all of one mind and so on. They were a diverse lot. They were a contentious lot, but they knew how to come to compromises. And a lot of these don't look good, but you know, in the end, well, we had the Civil War and so, you know, slavery and so on. So, the reverence serves a purpose, but the blind reverence and the idea that these guys were somehow, you know, demigods, you know, that does not, and it actually that is reactionary, because that is where we get to these ideas that you know, that every word has to be taken word for word, and you know, we can't have an air force, and we have to go back to slavery times, and you know, whatever it is, you know, it's just that doesn't make sense. So their greatest vision was to create a workable structure so that people could engage in a Republican form of government in which the people's representatives come together and work out their differences and create a strong, energetic, and vigorous nation. Those words, by the way, vigorous and energetic, are very crucial, because today you have a whole body of people thinking that the problem is the government, and the founders wanted the weakest government possible. And that is just totally not true. They had already had the weak government. They had a government that was small enough that it would drown in a bathtub, to use a proper Nyquist. They had one, $663. That's you can drown that in the bathtub. They didn't want that. Their process, it was, you know, just checkered with these words, you know, vigorous and energetic. But they didn't want it to. They didn't want. They were wary of the abuse of power, and that's where the separation of powers come in. The separation of powers was not to weaken the government. They wanted a strong one. But if they wanted a strong government, they wanted to separate the powers so no single locus of power could control everything. This is not the president's nation. This is not Congress's nation. This is not the Supreme Court's nation. It's the nation for all the branches of government, all the parties, to work it out. That was the point, folks. Work it out. That's what our Constitution is all about.
Yeah, just one final question I have for you. And we talked about a little bit about reverence for the Constitution. And I think, though, more people, at least I'm hearing more people, maybe just in academia, I don't know, make arguments like, well, The Constitution has been a remarkably effective document. It's worked for us for a long time, but it was a document put together in an agrarian pre-industrial revolution society. And now it seems like something like maybe a parliamentary system, or we have issues with the First Amendment and campaign finance. And maybe it's just a point where the Constitution simply no longer effectively meets the needs of 21st century America. What do you think about that in closing?
That is a self-defeating argument, because the thing is, it does meet the needs. All you have to do is adapt it to the needs. I mean, you know, just like the campaign financing. I mean, that's another example of this originalism thing. Oh yeah, they didn't want the money is speech. You know, that's what they, you know, money is speech. That supposedly an originalist argument is so bizarre. The framers were absolutely, their greatest overriding concern was private influence over the public good. You know, private, you know, they wanted to create the government that represented the people and the interests of the nation as a whole. And they were just, they would be absolutely petrified and offended by the idea that special interests control government or influence government. The influence of private interests over government was antithetical to everything they were trying to do. Now, it's not the Constitution itself that's outdated. I mean, it was working pretty well, up until quite recently. It's how we are in a sense abusing it. And when you look at what happened, you know, it was very difficult to get that Constitution ratified, because probably a good half of the people were anti-federalists, and so they were wary of that, but it did get ratified. And imagine today if we had to start from scratch, and we can't even work out a bipartisan tax reform, and we're supposed to revamp the entire rules. You're not going to get a constitutional amendment, let alone the Constitution, that two-thirds of the state, I mean, you know, that two-thirds of Congress and three-quarters of the states agree to, because anything that you do is going to when you analyze it by your, not the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, but the CPO, the Congressional Politics Office, is going to reveal that it's going to help Democrats more than Republicans, or Republicans more than Democrats. And as soon as that becomes obvious, some upwards of 40% of the nation is going to not like it. Right. I mean, this is not the kind of environment where you can start from scratch. This is the kind of environment where darn it, you should start trying to rein it in, bring it back in and get into a normal human mode of communication with each other. And take a good hard look at what the true spirit of that Constitution is, which is to create a workable, effective government that works for the people. And for that, you need political compromise, and we better start getting there.
Absolutely. I think that's a great place to close. So with that, we will close. Ray Raphael, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today.
Of my pleasure. I just love to talk about the Constitution, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to do so.
That's it for this episode. Thanks for listening. We hope you liked what you heard. Listener support is a really big help to us, and we truly do appreciate it. If you're interested in joining our great group of Politics Guys supporters, you can go to politicsguys.com and click on the Patreon link. And if you'd like to support the show without spending anything, it really does help if you get the word out by sharing this episode with your friends and followers, or passing along our new show posts and tweets on Facebook and Twitter. Leaving reviews and ratings on iTunes also does really help. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can do that at mail@politicsguys.com or through our Facebook page, where you can message us and we post stuff throughout the week. That's facebook.com/politicsguyspage. We're also on Twitter @politicsguys. The executive producers of The Politics Guys are Michael Baranowski, Jay Carson, Trey Orndorff, and Bruce Johnson. Today's show was produced by Michael Baranowski. We'll be back with a new show on Saturday. We hope you'll join us.